it wasn't like it is now, where you might play, you know, GAA and soccer and all sorts of other games as well. It really had a stigma.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts, and download the OTB Sports app.
Now, I've got to say, really looking forward to chatting to our next guest. She's taken the road less travelled in life, and Brendan Doyle, you are very welcome. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me on. I'm great, thanks.
I was just complimenting you before we started there on your wonderful microphone sound, which is great. So perfect for a chat like this. For people who are thinking that name rings a bell, Brendan Doyle, you were in the media in the last month or so looking for funding, which we'll get on to. But in short, the plan, all going well, touching wood, is that at the Winter Olympics in Beijing in the winter of 2022, you will be there, hopefully. You will be competing for Ireland. You were, as I understand it, one qualification place away from making the Winter Olympics of 2018 in South Korea. And the sport we are talking about is?
Skeleton, yeah. You know, 2018 was actually quite an interesting time. I was actually a single point off. So it was as close as it could be. And it floored me not getting there. But basically, I just use it as experience. And, you know, we're already, I don't know how, but we're already 4 years down the line. And, you know, I leave next Saturday for Vancouver. So I start my preparations for this Olympic season.
Well, I was reading that in terms of qualification now for 2022. God, it's hard to keep track of time.
Yep.
For qualification for 2022, in a sense, we're talking about races at various tracks. And you're pretty happy with how it folds out for you. You've hit the lottery a little bit. The tracks that you seem to like or seem to suit you will go a long way towards deciding qualification. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Being from Europe, you would assume that I would have kind of picked the German tracks, the Austrian tracks. There's a ton of tracks closer to home. But how I got into the sport was through Sean Greenwood, who competed for Ireland in the Sochi Olympics in 2014. And he's based in Calgary in Canada. So when I basically decided to do this like full tilt, I approached him, and he kind of took me on how he did it, which is predominantly North American tracks. So you have Whistler, Calgary, Lake Placid in New York, and you've got Park City in Utah. So they're the four tracks that I've essentially grown up and learned on. And they just happen to be the tracks now that I'm most proficient on. There's two tracks where I would be up there world-class level. So to see that those tracks came up in this year's schedule was bigger than a lottery win for me, because you know, the things that are outside of my control. And just when those things go well for you, it's rare in sport that they do. And when they do, it's such a beautiful feeling. So, you know, it's got me excited.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, listen, later on, I'll get into the minutiae of the technique involved in your sport. Mm-hmm. For the time being, just for the purpose of the question, very blunt summary of your sport. People have seen Cool Runnings. You run, you push very hard, and then you jump on what is effect, you know, skateboard type thing on the ice, and you are on your belly and your chest, and you zoom around a track. So just to give people a visual, up to 140 odd kilometers per hour. Those tracks, as opposed to the European tracks, the American tracks, are there certain things about those tracks which suit you? Like, are there you know, more turns, or some tracks I'm sure are faster than others? All these things must come into it.
Yeah. Pretty much aced my sport there. It is quite mental. It's just so quick. It's Formula One on ice, essentially. You know, and there are differences in the tracks. Every track has its own characteristic, and to the extent where I won't even talk about a track because I know it's listening to me. So like, I respect every track I go to. But the American tracks are a lot more like wavy. So they'll have two or three pressures, like, you know, kind of like if you think of an M, kind of it goes up and down. I'll have two or three of those within a corner, where European tracks seem to be a little bit more on off. And then the European tracks will have something called a Kreisel, which is a corner that goes 180 degrees, or even the one in Beijing now, which is 360 degrees. So it's kind of like a loop on itself. So you don't have them too much in North America. They're faster tracks. The fastest track in the world is in Whistler in Vancouver. That's where I clocked 145 kilometers an hour. But the European tracks are just so difficult, so precise, because they're a little less tricky, if you get me. So it's more finesse for those tracks.
Right. Okay. And so, because you mean it would be very easy to assume that the most important aspect of the ride is to get a good start, and you know, you would practice your sprinting. I know you were a sprinter in your youth, and to get as much speed going as possible, and then really, how much can you do? But obviously, is it just subtle leanings with your body here and there, and judging when to do it? And I mean, I presume there's no way you never try and slow the thing down. I presume, like coming into a turn, there's no way to hold the brakes, or is there?
No, you don't want to hold the brakes either. So the whole idea behind Skeleton is build as much speed as you can. So the kind of rule of thumb is for every tenth of a second, you're faster up top. If you don't mess up, it's worth six tenths of a second down bottom. So the faster you are up top, the better. But there's so much to do on the sled. And, you know, sometimes doing nothing is right. Sometimes you have to do a lot. So it's so situational. And that's why, you know, that there's a lot of people in my sport who would be, you know, pushing the 30s and early 40s, mid 40s, because it's such an experiential sport and there's so much to it. So like other sports where I could kind of compare it to would be like, you know, mountain biking. You have to kind of get the bike to push through the corners. Surfing, you have to pump the wave. So a lot of these, like even skateboarding, like skateboarding with the way they go down a half pipe, you have to pump pressure through the corners and you have to try to get every working for you, because we don't have that accelerator. So if we make a mistake or we break, that's just time left on the track. So
yeah, you're leaking time. And is every, I was going to say drive, what do you guys call it? Ride?
Drive, slide.
Is every drive different, or are you pretty much doing, you know, well, that's just the perfect way to attack that circuit, and so you're just trying to do that the same time every time? Or are there just certain different variables at play whereby you have to judge it in the moment quite a bit?
So the sport is kind of like an onion. There's layers to it. So, you know, when you first start, you just want to get from top to bottom, right? And then you want to do things like that, the safe steers, where you can get through a corner safe, but you're just scrubbing all your time and there's no momentum building. The level I'm at, what I'm trying to do now is as little as possible. So I'm trying to set the sled up in such a way that the track does the work for me, so I don't have to brake. So it just sets me up on a good line. Kind of like when you see Formula One drivers or rally drivers talk about entrances and exits of the corners, that's huge. Like, you know, in Park City, what I do in corner one will affect what I'm doing in corner six. It's so connected. So there's so much nuance. No slide is the same, but the idea is to try to get as much consistency as possible and try to get the track to do as much as possible, because anything I do is a break.
I understand. So on a good slide, you start well and you probably feel like you're doing very little and it's a state of flow and you're at one flow with the sled and you're at one with the circuit, and it's almost stress-free, as much as stress-free can be at 130 plus K per hour. Whereas on other slides, you start off not great and you're constantly adjusting and rescuing and tweaking and searching.
Yeah, for sure. A nice little analogy is being in the eye of a storm. Either side of where you are, you're in the middle of a storm. You're being thrown around. But if you're in the right spot where you need to be, it's your steers are just so small, and you're just like touching the steer, and the sled will do all the work. There's those slides where it just gets away from you, and you're constantly behind, and every mistake compounds. So you know, the mistake and the time and everything just gets away from you. It happens. It's part of the sport, and it does teach you to have a good memory, but also at the same time a bad memory. You want to forget the bad ones, but you want to remember why.
Yeah, I sound like a terrible name drop. We had Nigel Mansell on the show a couple of years ago, and he was saying that when you're in that state of flow, it doesn't feel like you're going that fast. You're seeing everything miles ahead of time. It's actually slow motion. It's only when you suddenly go off balance, you realize the speed you're playing with is uncontrollable.
For sure. My fastest times aren't, I don't realize it until I look at the timesheet. So, you know, I get off at the end of the track and I was like, man, that just felt fantastic. Like I just had to do small bits and I was just dancing with my sled. And I get off and I'd look at the timesheets and I'm like, you know, the speed is, you know, top three or top four. And it's kind of like, that's wild. And it's such a fantastic thing about my sport is when you get into that flow state, there's nothing else on this planet. Like it is literally just me on my sled and I'm not even thinking about what's about to happen. I'm just in the now. I'm just flowing. I don't try to over control. I don't stress about what's already happened. I just accept what's happening and try to make the best of it. So it's a magical spot to be in. Mm. And when it goes well, it's amazing. And when it goes bad, it sucks because you're just hitting ice and it's just like a cheese grater.
The $1 million question for every sports person. Have you figured out a way to plug into that headspace more often than not?
Yeah, actually. So what's big in skeleton? I would say 98% of skeleton is the mind game. It's mental preparation. And we do a lot of visualization. So
I've seen Cool Runnings. I know you're getting into the bath.
Bathtub, you know it. Yeah, that's exactly like, so we'll break the track down to like, when you learn a track, it's lefts and rights, and then you single pressure, double pressure, and then you bring it back and you're like, okay, where do I want to enter? And then you start doing steers, like, what's the track doing to me? How do I mitigate that? How do I make that faster? And then when you have a game plan written down, you go through it in your mind, you close your eyes and you just think of yourself at the top of the track and you go down that track mentally. And it's something, you walk into a changing room in a skeleton or a bobsled track, there's going to be people with their eyes closed and they're going to be just gliding down this track. And that's exactly what you need to do because you don't have the time to think. Yeah. There's so much happening that if you're thinking, it's already happened. So, you know, visualization is huge. And the more you do it, the easier it is for you just to kind of sink into this like flow state. Like, I can't say I'm going to get into a flow state, but just when I start queuing up certain things, my brain just knows we're about to slide and then it just happens. But yeah, the visualization is huge. It's played a massive part in the sport and I'd be lost with it. Like I use a VR headset here in Ireland. I lie on my sled, I'll slap on an Oculus 2 and I'll go down the track, you know, watching the video. I'll just, you know, drive down the track on the sled. And then when I get out to the track, I obviously just do it for real.
Yeah. And in so much as I can see, you spend a lot of your time training at Abbottstown.
Yeah.
So I presume in that way, and you seem to have like almost metal train tracks built on a running track and you use those to kind of practice your push off and various bits and bobs. It would strike me all the same. You must be at a massive disadvantage compared to the bloke who lives in Austria and goes down an actual circuit every day, or no?
Yeah. I mean, look, there's huge, I mean, we could play that game all day. Like, I mean, there's nations who have McLaren making their sleds. I'm going up against teams with huge teams behind them of mechanics and psychologists, and they all have their own push tracks and some even have ice push tracks. So, you know, come August, they're pushing in August on ice. It's a very surreal feeling when you're pushing on ice because the sled's around 35, 40 kilos. It's heavy. So you're trying to kind of push that downhill, but, you know, the ice takes away a lot of the friction. So it's hard to simulate. But, you know, I just have to do what I can with the materials available at the cost that I can afford to get as close as possible. You know, I could sit here and be like, you know, everyone else has more to me, but that's not going to service me well. I just have to find the solutions to kind of bridge that gap.
Yes. And have you managed to set up whatever you're pushing at Abbottstown to a certain weight so that it in some way mirrors the lack of friction of the ice? Like, have you made it heavier? Have you made it lighter? What's been your aim in that sense?
Not particularly. No. What I'm doing in Abbottstown is essentially just getting mechanics down. So, you know, pushing a sled, kind of bent over and only pushing it with one hand. There's a lot of things that you need to be able to cue up and balance and coordination and timing of the strides. And at what point, you know, do I switch from running to I'm about to jump on and then to actually load onto the sled. So there's like technique involved in the push aspect.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things as well is when we're pushing the sled on ice, it's actually just resting in a groove. Like, so the ice is just normal and they just kind of chisel out a groove all the way down. Right. So the sled will wobble in that groove. And if we're pushing laterally, if we're pushing into the groove at all, it can pop out and that's the end of your run. You're finished. Hmm. So a lot of the work that I do is try to run with my sled, try to push the sled linear and not have that like kind of instinct to like lean into it, which is, it's just a killer when that happens.
Yeah, I can imagine. How dangerous is this sport?
How much practice are you putting in? if you're working at it a lot and you focus and you listen to your coaches, you know, it mitigates a lot of danger. I mean, saying that, I've torn ligaments in my ankles. I've, you know, bruises pretty much for the first 2 or 3 years. Everything was just bruised, swollen. you can't come off. It can hurt. You know, there's people who've broken collarbones, ankles, ribs, that kind of stuff. But I mean, it's those injuries tend to come from panicking and overworking on a sled. Theoretically, the track wants to get you down in one piece. It's us on the sled putting us into weird positions and panicking. So it's the first year is very overwhelming for sure. But the more you practice and focus and visualize, the less it becomes about the danger. Now on the flip side, when you start hauling and you're moving and you're hitting those 146s and you're really trying to do very little, that can bite you as well, because you're like, you know, you're letting things happen. You're letting it go a little bit. So you kind of go from that overworking to not doing enough. So it's just trying to find that balance. But when you're at that other end of the scale, you're more of where you are and what's going on.
Yeah. The reason I saw you in the media in the last month is that you set up a GoFundMe page. This thing, needless to say, I would think the cost of travel, the cost of keeping up with the sled technology is off the charts. You're not a funded athlete, as I understand it. So are you just pretty much out on your own here, Brendan?
I'm completely on my own. So basically, I started in 2016. From 2016 up to this season, it's been basically my life savings. I put everything into it. And I believed in it. I really did. I saw an opportunity to A, go to the Olympics with a sport that I have a natural affinity for, and B, is to be an example of people who have come from mental health struggles, to show that, you know, hey, you can amount to things, those things that you once thought, you know, not true. Like, look what I'm doing. So it's been difficult for sure. And every year I spend about 6.5 months struggling and worrying whether or not it's going to happen. And in kind of true Irish style, last minute saloon, the help comes in or something changes. And, you know, I didn't have to stress that much. So, you know, this year I was genuinely like, you know, of the opinion that it wasn't happening. And then, you know, I was just absolutely touched by the reception for my GoFundMe. And, you know, I've had companies like Harris Group coming in, and they're putting wind in my sails. Honestly, I was so worried about the season being a thing. I just my heart is full.
So have you got enough cash to get the ball rolling? Yeah.
We've got enough to get it going. You know, the season's a long one. We start off in Vancouver. We head on to Utah and then New York. And then final competitions are in Germany just after Christmas. I think I'm sliding New Year's Day or the day after. I don't know how much I'll have that tail end of the season, but I've enough to get out there now and make a charge. You know, we decided this year to go after a coaching team and a coaching staff that actually, you know, worked with me, as opposed to people who were available. I wanted the coach that, you know, would work for me. So that's added expense. And then, you know, funnily enough, you think, but finding insurance for this gig is so tough. It's brutal. So still looking out for that too.
Yeah. Well, we can't get anything insured at the moment, so I'm not surprised hear that. And without the GoFundMe effort in the last month, was your season in jeopardy? It sounds like it's been an amazing response then, if that's been the difference.
Oh, 110%. I was, you know, mentally prepared myself for the outcome of not going because of funds. It was a genuine outcome.
Okay.
For sure.
God, people are so good.
As I said, my heart is full. I'm Jen, like, there's it. I remember the day the video came out, and I was woken up by GoFundMe notifications, and I was like, what is, like, it wasn't my alarm. It was these notifications. I was like, what is this? I didn't know the video came out, so I didn't know people knew. And I was just like looking at it rolling in, and I just cried. I was like, this is the beginning. This is that changing moment where everything felt hopeless, and now suddenly it doesn't feel hopeless anymore.
God, that's amazing. Because I remember seeing the video, and I mean, we're all asked for money all the time. And I thought, well, best of luck to him. But I mean, skeleton, Winter Olympics, Ireland, will this hit home? So that's absolutely wonderful to hear. Brendan Doyle, search the GoFundMe page and throw in a few quid. That's great to hear that's happened for you. You mentioned there coming from mental health struggles. Did anyone kind of say to you in the last number of years, you said 2016, God, I don't know, is all this stress and all this worry about money, is that a good place to put yourself in? I know the flip side of that coin is, well, I'm pursuing something I love and I'm passionate about, so it's good. But I guess there is a balance there, isn't it? Because there is the glamour of traveling to these exotic places and the glamour of the good days. Mm-hmm. But any sports person I talk to can, especially I think in the Olympic movement, God can tell you about the nothing Tuesdays in November where it's pretty lonely and tough as well.
Oh, 100%. You know, traveling abroad in a sport where there's no support, you're very much on your own. And, you know, I think out of the last 5 or 6 years, I've had one Christmas in Ireland and the rest I've been sitting on my own, just like any other day, which is tough. And there was that anticipation, but I was thinking maybe this is going to be something too big for me. But at the same time, you know, I battled with so much. I was like, this is not going to be worse than what I've been through. So if I try it and I don't succeed or I can't accept it, well, that's fine. That's a line that I've tried to cross. And, you know, anyone in sport, doesn't matter what level, will kind of appreciate that. I'd say the majority of the time is letdown, setbacks, injury, upset. And it's just something that you become accustomed to almost. Skeleton is just so much more frustration because, as I said, it's so nuanced and there's so many moving parts. And again, I'm kind of starting off at a stage where, you know, this is my third, fourth year or whatever. And then there's guys in it 15 years. So that's my competition. It's not like I grew up in the sport and I kind of acclimated to the levels. I was thrown in this deep end with people 4 or 5 times my experience. So any kind of progression I was making was dwarfed by what they were doing. But again, it was just another example of kind of adapting this mindset of accepting the hardships and working through them. And essentially I've learned I've quit that sport so many times mentally. Sure. I've thrown the helmet on the ice, walked off. I said, I don't need this sled anymore. I'm going home. Like, this is ridiculous. And then I can never follow through with it. I just go home and I, you know, prepare my sled for the next day and just wake up and do it all over again. So there are those moments for sure, but I've just never followed through on them. But
if you'll allow me to probably get a few things slightly wrong, but just for the purposes of time, to maybe just sum up a few things and get us to a really interesting is the wrong word, but significant point in your life. So sprinter growing up, you know, 13, 14, 15 at Morton Stadium, actually got a look at bobsleighing there and bit of an interest. Economic crash in 08, and needless to say, Irish Bobsleigh Skeleton Federation is not high on the priority list. And so money is cut there and your relationship with the sport, it comes to a bit of a pause for sure. And to be honest, lots of sports did. I didn't even know we had a Bobsleigh Skeleton Federation, if I'm being totally honest. Yeah. But I know even the men's basketball team, women's basketball teams didn't compete in tournaments after the crash. So it's no surprise to hear Skeleton Federation took a hit. So that's 2008 or so. And you joined the Guards. You're there in 2009. I make it here 2009. You've left the bobsleigh training behind a touch. You're 22 years of age or so?
In around, yeah. In around. So I started the Guards in around 2007, 2008. So I got my first kind of, you know, insight into Skelly back in 2003.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
And so I guess a night which changes your life and the trajectory of it is, talk about it in as much detail as you're comfortable with, but in effect, it's you're called to an ugly scene and something horrible happens to you.
Yeah, it was May 2009. It was a night shift, actually. So you would kind of regularly do your night shifts 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And when you come in, the first thing you do is you get briefed by your sergeant. Hey, this is what's happened. These are the ridges you need to look out for. You know, just basically housekeeping stuff of what happened the shift before. But I actually didn't even get that far in. We basically turned in, and as I was getting my kit from downstairs in the locker room, I was just screamed at saying, we need to get into the car. There's an urgent call. So that's when you just sprint to the car and get into it and get to where you need to go. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, domestic assaults are something that are quite common. You would experience an awful lot of them, but they're probably the most volatile calls you go to because it's highly driven, it's highly personal. And then, you know, guards are kind of a third party person coming in to, you know, not necessarily wanted either. You know, there's going to be someone who doesn't want you there.
And maybe maybe both don't want you there. I'm sure it's complicated.
Yep. It is. It's like Skeleton, there's so many moving parts, and if one of them gets awry, it's just extremely, extremely dangerous.
Mm. Did you sense on arrival to this scene that this was a volatile one?
Not initially, because again, the information and the nature of the call was something that you do see. And we do kind of background checks on the way to the call to kind of have an idea of like, who are we dealing with here? Like, does this guy have, you know, firearms or a history of assault or something like that? And there was nothing jumping out at us that was like, this is going to be like insane. Like, we figure we get down there, we calm them down, we talk it out. And, you know, sometimes nothing comes of it. Sometimes you have to effect arrest. It's just down to the situation. But I kind of knew it was going a different direction that, When we pulled up outside the house, the front door swung open. So I was like, okay, this is going to be a little bit more kind of agitated. And my whole career, I was never one who enjoyed the hands-on aspects of policing. I always tried to use verbal reasoning. I tried to kind of just reason with them on a certain level. It's very difficult for people to have an argument if you're not fighting back. If you don't return that energy, they just get tired, and eventually, you know, they'll start listening to you. So that was my kind of my MO going into this. Let's just try to reason with him. But unfortunately, he wasn't here, and he wasn't listening. And he had a wooden bat in his hand. And he took it over his head as if he was going to strike me. So at that stage, I was like, okay, we have to bring this up a notch. I took out my baton, and my partner took out her baton. And I remember her radioing for backup. And as I started to approach the male, and it stopped being kind of questions and answers, it was more orders, drop the weapon and so on. He ran straight down the hall into the kitchen. And, you know, as I'm entering this house, you know, the person who called was screaming at us, get him out of here, get him out of here. She was visibly injured. So, you know, I didn't know what was going on in that kitchen. You know, Gardaí aren't really trained for this kind of call. You just have to kind of go with your gut, which is the scary thing. It's experiential learning, really. So you just have to trust yourself, trust your partner, and try to do the best you can in this storm, essentially. And as I was approaching the kitchen, I could see through, like, the door was like half wood, half glass, and I could see through it. So as I opened the door and I was kind of calling on him, you know, I'm at the door, drop the weapon, nothing's happened yet, we can still talk. He came out from behind the door with a chef's knife and just pointed it right at me. Like, and I'll never forget it. Like, my eyes went from his face to the blade, and I was just like, kind of like really taken back. And it was during the arrest where I didn't even feel getting cut. I was cut in my hand. So like my small finger is essentially just trapped at 90 degrees. And the nerves in my thumb, they've all been severed. So I don't really have feeling there. I don't remember that happening. I just remember, you know, feeling water, what I thought was water. It turned out to be my blood. And I was pulled out of the house, and we were waiting, man, what felt like for hours to get to hospital. I eventually got put into the back of another patrol car, and we went off to James's where the wound was stitched and looked after. And the staff there were just phenomenal. They just dropped everything and, you know, helped me the best they could. And, you know, you're getting through all of that and getting back home. And, you know, it was like 4 o'clock, just before 4 o'clock in the morning by the time I got home. So the incident, gosh, we were at scene just after, I'd say 10:04, 10:05. And it was like just before 4 a.m. that I got back to my house, and, you know, just, you know, told my folks and everyone that, like, you know, I'm okay, it's not a big deal. And I went to bed thinking that was it. And, you know, I woke up and yeah, it was sore, but again, I had a history of athletics and being injured, and you understand that there's like a, you know, phases of getting back and pain and rehab and whatever. So I didn't really think much of it. But basically I kind of went down this road that I wasn't ready for. I didn't expect this to go the way it did. I would start experiencing, you know, things like vivid night terrors. We've all had nightmares where you kind of wake up and you're kind of shook a little bit and you don't get back to sleep straight away and it's just in your head. Night terrors is just that multiplied by 100. It was so vivid. I would have kind of dreams of the suspect with the knife standing over me. I would think my hand is still bleeding, so I would wake up grabbing it to try to stop the blood. And my brain was just trying to process what was happening, but it was just giving it in this violent, vivid dreams. And I would wake up every morning just in a sweat, and I just wouldn't be able to go back to sleep. So it was very kind of a physical way, and I wasn't able to relax into going to sleep. So I started struggling going to bed. I was avoiding going to sleep because I didn't want to essentially be punched to wake up. And I started basically doing everything but going to bed. You know, I drive around Dublin and just try to fill the nights. And I returned to work kind of with that, like, kind of athlete's mentality. I said to myself, get back on the horse and just return to the situation, return to work, show yourself it's a once off, show yourself you'll be fine. And, you know, I tried my best. And when I got back to work, I'll never forget it. We had this, it was a D drive call, dangerous driver. Essentially, someone in the public calls in saying, hey, we've got like a guy speeding or, you know, swapping lanes or not staying in their lane or whatever. They'll give us a reg. We'll go to the air. We'll try to find them and stop them. Very like 9 times out of 10, they'll just be gone and we won't have any more information. So it's not a stressful call. But I remember sitting in the patrol car and I just felt my chest clench. And like, I felt like my stab vest was kind of pushing me down into the chair. And you know, being an asthmatic, I was like, I'm just having an asthma attack. That's all this is. And I grabbed my inhaler and took a puff and nothing changed. And that was for me even worse because, you know, this is the answer and the answer is not working. I returned to my sergeant, told him what was happening. And he's like, you need to, you know, go back off work, decompress and figure out what's going on. And I did. And unfortunately, it just kind of compounded. It got worse and worse. So I was still not sleeping. And I was getting very frustrated with myself because, again, you know, I'm used to setbacks. I'm used to injuries. But I'm also used to getting back on the horse and rehabbing and things like that. And just nothing was working. And those drives around Dublin initially were just, you know, a couple of hours, whatever. But they basically got to a stage where I would drive to Cork or to Sligo and back because I was just so afraid of getting into bed. I was, you know, really struggling with my identity because I wasn't fixing myself like I normally did. And, you know, my relationship at the time fell apart. Social just went out the window. And any little things that made me who I was, I stopped doing. You know, no training, I wasn't eating the way I normally eat, and I was a shell. And that went on for years. And I was just night after night of just feeling like I was letting my unit down, myself down, everyone around me down, feeling like I was never going to get any better. And it basically got to the stage where, you know, I legitimately felt the only logical option left to regain control of my own life was to end it, because it was the one action that I knew there was a definite outcome and it would give me a break from the storm and from the feelings that I was going through day in, day out. And, you know, I remember when I decided to do it, it was, I don't want to say blasé, but I wasn't worried. I wasn't scared. I was relieved in a way that I was like, look, I'm at this point now. There's no other options. I thought it through. It wasn't a knee jerk. I wasn't trying to send any messages. It was just purely like, I've tried everything. This is legitimately the only thing I have left.
You're almost at the point there where, unfortunately, you've convinced yourself it's a rational thing to do.
Yep. It was completely irrational. It was completely rational in my brain. Sorry.
And Brendan, how long after the incident had you reached that point?
The incident was 2009, and I would say it was 2014. in around 2014, where I was like, I'm done.
So you had five years effectively.
5 years.
Not sleeping.
Yeah. Like broken sleep.
Yeah.
You know, I my body would like switch off sometimes. You know what I mean? When your iPhone is dead, your iPhone is dead. That was the kind of thing I got to, but it was always waking up in that kind of turmoil and just uptight all the time, genuinely all the time. And there was no looking forward.
And
there
in was that no five, forward. In that 5 years, did you attempt to go back to work again or no?
Yeah. Yeah. I attempted to go back to work. I attempted to go back training. I don't want to say a model patient, but I did everything I could do. I went to my doctors. We went on pills. The only thing we didn't do was sleeping tablets. And there was a genuine concern for addiction. I didn't want to go down that road. Because
you see sometimes, not to generalize, but it might be hard for somebody who's gone through what you had gone through to verbalize how they were feeling. And anyone who's listened to you in this chat for the last while, you know, incredibly eloquent personality. So I would think sitting down with your counselor, you would have been able to revisit the incident and talk about it and air it. And still, for whatever reason, all that therapy and all that talking about it didn't seem to allow you to sleep and to get back to some kind of point of equilibrium. Like were your counselor or counselors struggling to come up with the answers for you? Do you remember?
So one of the funny things is when I was struggling, your train of thought is off. And I viewed counselors as someone who is sitting there because they're getting paid to. And I didn't view it as a stepping stone. I didn't view it as help. I viewed it as they were sitting there taking the little money that I had. And again, that's a broken train of thought, but that's what happens when you're in the position that I was in. I don't want to say I was resisting it, but I wasn't kind of going into it with open arms and like, let's really work with this.
Okay.
And again, it was not a reflection on their service. It was just, I wasn't willing to really go in and try because I was like, they're only here for my money. That's all they care about. Once the 60 minutes is up, we'll get back to it next week or whatever.
That's not an uncommon thought, I think, in that sphere, actually. You wouldn't be alone in feeling that way about the process. And at that stage, were you living with your family or were you living on your own?
Home, yeah.
Oh, home. And so that must have been absolutely terrifying for family. I don't know who were parents there or?
Yeah, my mom and dad. Funny enough, they didn't know anything was going on until I spoke about it in an interview. They had no idea.
And when was that that you spoke about?
Gosh, it would have been going into Pyeongchang Olympic year. I didn't.
Oh my God. Yeah. So did they not twig? Well, he hasn't gone back to work. He must be really struggling or?
They knew that there was struggles. They knew I was like really struggling with work. But there was never an understanding of how bad the struggles were. They understood that I needed time and they understood that, you know, like I was really passionate about the job. So like, you know, I would actively, like, I want to get back, you know, and that's what I allowed them to see. But everything else more than that, there was my friend who went on the drives with me. I'd say he was the only person that I genuinely like opened up to. And he was the only one who knew I really struggled. So everyone else, I put on a brave face, I suppose.
So your parents mightn't have known that you were driving out to Cork in the middle of the night?
Nope. Wow. They knew I wasn't there, but they didn't know what was going on.
Okay. Good friend. Missed getting a lot of sleep himself.
I genuinely, like, to this day, we still kind of joke about it because he caught some of what I had because he told me that, like, you know, he would... I would text him saying, do you want to go for a spin? And he would be afraid to say no because he was like, if he said no and I didn't come back, you know, there was that guilt. So we almost saw the car as a kind of a therapy session in a way, because you could get in there and we weren't like eye to eye. We were beside each other. So we could just like vent and just look at the road kind of thing. So,
well, again, generalizing is terrible, but they do say women can be face to face friends and men are better side by side friends.
Well, that was definitely the case there. Like, I don't know what it was, but it was just he'd get in the car and we'd start driving and then he'd just start talking and we're like, okay, we're venting now. But you know, he he struggled as much as I did. And you know, I went to him straight after my attempt, and I told him, because again, I felt safe telling him, and B, I just wanted to be held accountable. I wanted someone else to know. I was like, okay, this is getting out of hand. Like, I've kind of hit the rock bottom. Yeah. And I knew that telling him, he wouldn't change how he viewed me. He wouldn't kind of wrap me up in bubble wrap. But he would talk it out and he would address it. So he'd be like, you know, you're the same person I know. You're just going through a hard time. Kind of like if someone breaks their legs, you're not like, you know, babying them or whatever. You just like get your legs sorted and then we'll get back to it. So that was the kind of relationship we had between each other. And it kind of saved me as well, because there was a certain normality to it that when I told him, he was like, you know, made fun of me. We went, got chocolate, sat down, and then we talked. So it was like, yeah, you're sick, there's something wrong with you, but that's not the end, you know, you're here, let's work on it. So he was the one who got me back into the gym and back training. He was like, it was the one thing that we met doing athletics. So it was the one thing we both kind of shared. And he knew as well that when you're training, your mind switches off, you're in the gym, you're not thinking about everything. So he's like, if anything, it's an hour or 40 minutes of like just you time, just go and train. So I would say I owe my life to that guy for sure.
Oh. And so you start doing a bit of training after that. Mm-hmm. Rock bottom. Does that start to help clear the fog?
It, you know what, it tired me out, which led to a bit of sleep. And it wasn't, I didn't go back trying to break world records. I just went back to try to get habit and structure. And one thing was, there was a kind of a turning point where I remember I had a playlist, and like when the playlist was on my computer, it just went off. And then that made me want to go to the gym. So that was the first time I was proactively saying, I want to do something. And it was like, okay, let's act on this. And it was just a building from it. And getting back to the gym, I was back with people who were in the sport. So they're like, come compete, you know, let's see you back on track. Why not? Like, not everybody knew what was going on, but you know, people knew I wasn't around. So when I came back, they were delighted to see me back. And yeah, that was the step. I think that was the stepping stone for sure.
Yeah. So if the incident is 09, the attack, and then the attempt is rock bottom, yeah. What year is that? What year is rock bottom followed by some reintroduction to exercise?
Put it this way, rock bottom was Monday. I was in the gym by Wednesday or Thursday because I was like scared.
Okay. And what year was that? What year was that?
That was the same year. So whatever, 2013, 2014, around that time. Yeah. Okay. So it was a scary moment. It was like, and that's why I went, like, I told him in Tesco's, you know, it wasn't like a big setup and a big intervention. We were walking through Tesco's. I remember passing the banana in the fruit aisle, and I looked at him and said, this is what's after happening.
Yes.
And it was just, I was scared. I was like, this got out of hand. So when he said, get back to the gym, I'm like, get back to the gym.
Life often doesn't happen in as dramatic a way as it would be portrayed in the movie.
No,
that conversation wouldn't happen at Tesco, but I guess you just had to say it while you were able to say it.
Well, I was brave enough to say it, yeah. Or scared enough to say, whichever way you want to put it.
Yeah, same coin, I guess. Your parents must have been utterly devastated, horrified to read subsequently where you were.
Yeah, they were for sure. And mother's extremely religious, and she's just, you know, thanking whoever she can thank that I'm here. We hear people talking about, you know, the selfish nature of the act, and it's just a broken train of thought. It's, you know, I was at such a point where there was nothing else, you know, and you get so bogged down that you don't have the energy. You just don't have the energy.
Well, 4 or 5 years of, well, one, the incident, and then not being able to sleep effectively for basically 4 or 5 years, and then not being able to return to work. It's no shock that your mental health was in absolute tatters. How's your sleep now, as a matter of interest? Can you still be hit with a terrible dream and terrible images, or where are you?
I sleep like a baby, 8-9 hours a day. Training is so difficult. Training is so difficult, and I've got so much on my plate right now preparing for Beijing that,
yeah,
you know, it and this is my point. This is what I'm trying to kind of get across with this whole effort is, you know, yeah, we can all break and we can feel like there's no hope, but I am rehabbed and I'm stronger for what I've been through. I genuinely feel that like what I've struggled with in the past is helping me deal with what happens now in skeleton, dealing with the Olympics, dealing with things that are outside of my control. I've been through worse. I've come back from worse. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, things like sport is everything to me, but it's in the big scheme that it's not really relevant. You need your happiness, you need your health. And now that I have that, you know, I just want to scream to people that like you can actually build yourself and you can be stronger because of your struggles. I just hope that, like, you know, doing a sport like skeleton where it's so mentally demanding, it's so dangerous, it's literally you're facing fear every single day, that I can be that example. It's what I hope anyway.
You must have almost cried with tears of joy and happiness when you woke up for the first time after a good night's sleep in a very, very long time and started to build up. God, that's two nights sleep. Maybe there's a step or two back. Maybe it wasn't just one sweet kind of straight line of improvement, but I'm sure you noticed, God, that's three or four nights in a row. God, that's five mm-hmm. nights in a row. God, yeah. I'm on a 7-night streak.
Yeah.
That must have been an unbelievably reassuring period where you thought, okay, there's a way back here.
For sure. And it wasn't linear by any stretch, but
I'll bet.
The days where it didn't go the direction that I wanted to go, it didn't feel like I was going backwards. It just felt like an off day.
Yeah.
And basically all came to a head when I basically decided to step back from the Gardaí. And it was a job that I fought hard to get into. It was a job that I was passionate about. I love the idea of being able to help people. That's why I joined. It's as simple as. Obviously permanent pensionable job, all that jazz, but you know, life is bigger than just paychecks. Like I had an opportunity to be that person to help. And within the job, it was, I would speak to people inside the job and I'd be like, you know, I don't know what to do here. I've worked hard to get back on my feet and I don't want to go back to where I was, but I also fought hard for this job and I loved it. It was really rewarding job. And within the job, it was leave, you know, look after yourself. It's only a job. But outside the job, where my friends and family are like, are you like, really, you're going to step away from the permanent pensionable jobs, security, safety, consistency, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it was, I had a wonderful conversation with an inspector, came out to my house and we sat down and had a cup of tea. And it was like, I've tried everything. It's not worth the potential outcome of staying in and going backwards. It's not worth it. So that permanent pension job that I'm trying to like battle for, that job satisfaction, he was like, you'll get that elsewhere. Mm. You go back here, there's a potential for something. Like I really tried. I really, really tried. And you know, I would be hiding in the bathroom in the station to avoid, you know, certain aspects.
I'll bet. Do you or did you carry a lot of anger towards this guy with a knife who takes a mindless slash and probably doesn't ever give much thought to the damage he caused to you and your family?
No, that's wasted energy. You come across kind of people like that all the time and you just have to like water off a duck's back. You don't carry that home. You carry that home, you're done. You just can't. So it was very much me being in a situation, kind of like, you know, an injury, you sprain your ankle. You could sit around all day going, I shouldn't have jumped off that step, but here you are, you have a sprained ankle, you have to fix it. So that's where my mind was. I wasn't focused on who, what, where, whatever. Yeah. I just wanted to be myself again. So
yeah.
I didn't spend the energy on them, to be honest.
Okay, good. So, God, I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. I can't imagine what that period's like. It just sounds utterly horrific.
Awful.
Yeah, I have to say, my God, yep. to live with it all that time. Mm-hmm. So to segue to something less important again, but I guess the point of the conversation, do you feel like you've got a good chance here of Winter Olympics 2022, the way it's mapped out? You must be very excited about a year. It's a big year in your life.
I'd say it's the biggest year of my life. I don't say that because it's the Olympics. It's since I started Skeleton, I started on the back foot, no money. I don't have the support, but I had fight and I had the kind of goal just to really, really just hyper perform and just outdo myself. So when I missed out at the Olympics in 2018 by a single point, that was the heart. Like I was up there with what I went through in the guards. That was soul crushing because I put my heart and soul into it. And, you know, unfortunately my father passed that year as well, just before leaving for the games, my father passed. So I was kind of dealing with that. And it was just such a difficult year, and getting through it. I remember speaking to one of my good friends out on tour, and he was asking me, am I going to watch it? And I was like, I can't watch it. I just can't watch it. And then I found myself looking at timesheets. Like, I can look at timesheets, just not watching it, and gives me an idea of what's going on. And I started looking at timesheets, and I was like, oh, guessing who's going to medal. And then I was like, oh, look, I'll just watch it. So I watched it. And when I saw it, I was like, I'm going to finish so high in the rankings that no amount of chess or any kind of red tape or anything is going to touch me. And I was like a turning point for me where it just became this absolute laser focus. So the years after, I made a 4-year plan, what I need to do. You know, year one, I went off, qualified for World Championships and had Ireland's highest finish in Whistler. That was 2019. 2020, I decided to head off to Europe where I was going to take a performance hit, but I wanted to learn European tracks. I felt it was necessary for me to build my wheelhouse should something happen to one. Like one of the refrigeration tracks could just like break. We can't race, so we have to go to a different track. So I was like, I need to, you know, increase my wheelhouse. So I went off on World Cup, which is the highest level. I qualified that after my World Championships finished. Went off and competed on World Cup at all of the tracks where I had less than 10 runs on. So strapped someone into a Formula One car, put them in Silverstone with 4 laps and race against Lewis Hamilton. That's what I was doing on camera, you know, full visibility. But I knew that my goal wasn't to compete. My goal was to absorb as much information from the best in the world so I can like execute that this year. Last year was a tricky year with COVID.
What happened?
What happened? I actually started off, my 4-year plan had me focusing in on North America. So I increased my wheelhouse and I was like, all right, let's go to the tracks I'm good on and change good to world-class, you know, so move up that echelon, the race within the race, move up that next segment in the race. And I went to Winterberg, which is in Germany. And there was that first competition that was there. We need to get competitions in last year so we can qualify for the Olympics this year. And I remember being out there and I was training with a teammate of mine from Israel and some of the Swedish guys and a guy from Denmark. And we're all just kind of ripping runs, having a good time. And then basically the circuit would come in and everyone would start doing their official training before the race. So we had a few days of just pay training where you pay for your runs yourself. And there was about maybe 10 of us, super relaxed. We were able to social distance. We were able to do the whole thing. And we started getting messages saying, oh, this country's contracted COVID. This country has COVID. The last race, a bunch of people had COVID. And I was sitting there and I was like, looking at the start list. And I was like, there's like 40 sliders coming here and this changing room can only house 28 people. I got in my car, drove back home, got the ferry back to Ireland and then flew over to the States. And I said, worst comes to worst, if I get stuck, I'm stuck at a track that I wanted to execute my goals on. So I went to Park City. I got my 90-day visa with the help of the Olympic Federation of Ireland. They, honestly, I would not be here without them. They've been fantastic.
Great.
And we got that set up. And I remember the Department of Homeland Security like texting me like, you're on day 89, you have to leave the country tomorrow kind of thing. But I was over there and I just 3 months of just sliding that one track executing the fundamentals to a high, high degree. I really pushed hard on just the smallest things. I don't get that chance. So the way I got into skeleton, I just started racing track. That was the first moment of my career where I had time to sit down and go, what is the day one things we need to do? And how can I do them without even thinking to the highest degree that I can do them? So that's what I spent my time doing. And it was so incredible to feel how much I improved. You know, we had three competitions there. I have one bronze and two silvers. On the last day, I was like 0.05 behind a two-time Olympian who's like, local track is that track. I was like, from a lad from Dublin who has a metal sled in his track, like in the track and field club. I'm happy with this. You know what I mean? So I made something out of of that like situation. It was a scary situation. I kept to myself the whole time.
Well, listen, it's been just fascinating talking to you. And Brennan Doyle, I sincerely hope we see you at the Winter Olympics in Beijing in 2022. It would just be amazing. People, and I'm sure lots of people were inspired by your story, listen to you, want to help out and throw a few quid your way, because you are doing this on your own, really. You've launched a GoFundMe page. So search Brennan Doyle and GoFundMe and people will find you there. And I am just conscious as well, if anybody listening was affected by the conversation or in a similar position to where Brennan was, hopefully you can certainly see there's always the very distinct possibility of better days ahead. So you can reach out maybe and talk to someone, Samaritans on 116123 or AWARE on 1890-303-302. Good places to start if you were in a similar spot to where Brennan was for a time. Brennan Doyle, absolute pleasure, my man. Very best of luck. I'll be watching your progress.
Cheers. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.